Coming up on Triangulation, it's Brian McCullough, host of the Internet History Podcast, the Tech Meme Ride Home, and the new book, How the Internet Happened from Netscape to the iPhone.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Triangulation, episode 371, recorded Friday, November 2nd, 2018. Brian McCullough, How the Internet Happened. This episode of Triangulation is brought to you by LastPass. Secure every password-protected entry point to your business. Join over 43,000 businesses and start managing and securing your company's passwords today. Learn more at lastpass.com/twit. And by Toto Washlet. Upgrade a once mundane trip to the bathroom into a spa-like experience with Washlet. To learn more and for special savings, go to wayfair.com/triangulation and enter the promo code triangulation at checkout. Welcome to Triangulation. This is a show where we talk to some of the most interesting people writing about or working on the internet today. And today I am very excited to talk about some internet history. We have with us Brian McCullough, who of course is the host of the Internet History Podcast and the author of the new book, How the Internet Happened from Netscape to the iPhone. Welcome to the show, Brian.
Megan, so good to be talking with you again.
It is really good to be talking to you. I should also say you are the host of the Tech Meme Ride Home podcast as well, which is a great short daily news podcast, which I know how hard it is to do since I once did that. And so I love listening to it. It's great.
Oh, thank you.
We were just talking about this a little bit. I am 45, so this is one of the first history books that I've read that not only takes place all during my lifetime, but also the meat of it takes place after I was an adult already. And I assume the same is maybe you may be a little younger than me, but
I'm 40.
Okay, so yeah. So maybe you were a bit of a youngster then, like during the time this book starts in the Netscape era.
Yeah, I remember it, though. And, you know, just as a little bit of background, I don't want to bore people, but, you know, I'm not a historian. I'm not a journalist. I wasn't a writer. But I founded three web companies. The first one was in 99. So the joke that I've been making is that I just was annoyed that no one had written the book about my career or the industry as I knew it. And so maybe in a way that's what it is.
Yeah. I mean, the part that I feel like was ripe for a book, I always thought was the .com era, because I moved to San Francisco in 98 and it was just like the very beginnings of that. And it was a wonderful time to be alive.
It certainly was. Yes.
So I do want to hear a little bit about your background. How did you get into internet history? Besides starting those companies, what interested you about internet history?
Well, it just bothered me that there was no book about when the internet entered our lives. There's excellent books. I have them on my shelf. Where the Wizards Stay Up Late, you know, John Markoff's book. There's all sorts of about internet culture, even the academic books about going back to ARPANET and how the internet came out of academia / military government stuff. What has been more transformative, disruptive, whatever, to all of our daily lives and normal people as well than the internet? And so I kept waiting for someone to do a book that said, well, yeah, remember AOL? Here's what happened to AOL. Or here's why Facebook beat MySpace. Or and the thing that I thought about was people have very personal connections. These are companies, they're corporations. On one sense, you can say, well, that's boring to talk about. But like my wife argued vociferously for more about Excite, because Excite was where she got her first email address from. You know what I mean? And I fought hard to keep information about GeoCities in there, because people of a certain age listening, that was your first homepage. And when you were 13, that's where your identity was and things like that. So I thought that someone should do a book about how these things infiltrated all of our lives. not only for the people that live through it to be like, here's the people that did this to you, here's the decisions that they made, here's the mistakes that they made, but also for if you're especially if you're entering tech and you're 26 and you don't even know there was a MySpace or an AOL or whatever, here's how we got to now.
Yeah, I mean, in many ways, the characters of the books are these companies, these companies as you go through. And, they're sort of historical figures when you think about, like, companies like, you know, Mosaic, like, or products as well, or characters Mosaic, that is something that people haven't thought about. And then, I mean, even more recent, towards the end of the book, like, companies like Singular, which was the first deal with the iPhone. Like, they're old friends in our lives that are no longer there anymore. And it was, like, re-meeting them and learning more than I had known about them. So, but why did you, the bookends are Netscape and the iPhone. Why did you choose those and not say like Internet Explorer and Google?
Yeah. Well, I'll take the second part first because it's the easiest one to answer. The modern technology world that we live in, if you didn't at least explain how we got social and mobile, then I didn't think that people would be informed about how we got to the now. The reason I started with Netscape, there's many reasons. But again, because I remember Netscape going public. I was one of those nerdy kids that watched the nightly news every day at 6:30. And I can remember vaguely, but I can remember that led the news that night, that there was this company that did something called an IPO, and it was worth billions of dollars. And people seemed to think that this was really crazy and unusual and weird. And one of the things that I hope I captured in the book is we're used to today this entrepreneurial culture. This, you can, 20-year-olds, you know, go to Silicon Valley to strike it rich and be worth billions of dollars. This is a recent thing. In the 80s, I'm a kid of the 80s, in the 70s, 80s, into the 90s, you wanted to be a rock star, you wanted to go on Wall Street if you wanted to get rich. This idea that you could create a company and it could be a thing. I feel like in my childhood, there weren't new companies invented all the time either. So the fact that Netscape, you can argue, is the first .com, it was the first real company to be an internet company. The IPO was the IPO heard around the world. Mark Andreessen has a quote that's in the book where he said when he went out to Silicon Valley in 93, or I think it was early 94 actually, he thought it was dead. He thought he had missed it. The PC boom was over. Of course, he was the one that made Netscape happen, made that IPO heard around the world happen. So I think that we have to start there if we're talking about the companies and the people that were going to bring the internet into our lives. I've said many times, I feel like the book could have been called How the Internet Happened to Us as well.
Yeah, I mean, that is a good point, because of course the internet existed long before Netscape. Mm-hmm. But you know, it wasn't for us. It wasn't personal. Mm-hmm. It wasn't navigable as easily. And even during the time of Netscape, it really wasn't. So talk a little bit, like, Netscape was already known. They'd been around for only 16 months when they IPO'd, but they were known. Talk a little bit about that time when they were about their IPO.
It is kind of interesting. Actually, I started. We should also say that the Internet History Podcast was started as a process of researching this book, because I was getting these great interviews and I thought, well, I'll sit on this for 4 years and two sentences that guy told me will make it into the book. So, by the way, if you like this book, there are almost 200 episodes of the primary source interviews. And I started with five of the six guys that were recruited from University of Illinois to go out and create Netscape. It is surprising to me how much they had a lot of hype at a time where there wasn't a lot of hype for technology. This is 94 into 95. I guess we can credit Roseanne Sino that I've had subsequently on the Internet History Podcast. She was a PR guru that Jim Clark brought over from Silicon Graphics when he and Mark Andreessen started Netscape. But I also think that it was this It was Jim Clark being a superstar. Jim Clark is famous for being one of the few and possibly the only person still to have founded $3 billion companies. He gets hooked up with Mark Andreessen. Mark Andreessen is this not superstar, but he was marketed as this whiz kid nerd superstar. He was in People Magazine's Most Interesting People. I discovered that researching the book in 94 or 95. So, yeah, they were hyping this up as a new thing. And then I think that the thing that made Netscape, the hype around Netscape, really, really take off. And I talked to a lot of people, Wall Street people from the time about this, is that if you think about the landscape in 94, 95, it's hard to visualize this today, but there was one game in town and it was Microsoft. Microsoft had slain all of its rivals, and it's impossible if you weren't there to realize how much they were astride the technology industry, and there was nobody else. And if anyone else came up, they were going to kill. And so the promise of Netscape from day one was they were going to do to Microsoft what Microsoft had done to the entire technology industry, that they were going to be a platform play, that Microsoft was this platform first with DOS and then with Windows, that if everybody in technology had to either be on, pay a toll to Bill Gates to be on, or what have you. And so by popularizing and mainstreaming the web browser, the thinking went, would be a platform and a software platform that would rival what Microsoft had achieved with Windows. And you know, Microsoft pioneered things like doing plugins and things like that because they wanted to be this platform play. And so I think a lot of the hype was, if again Silicon Valley and the tech investing world in general had been sort of in a lull. And all anyone could think of is, oh man, you missed investing in the Microsoft IPO in 1986. Well, here's your second chance. Mm. And so I think that was a lot of what it was, is everyone saw that this was the second Microsoft.
And Microsoft, of course, did not jump on the internet bandwagon really so early at all. Talk about what were they doing during this time, I guess they were developing Windows 95.
Well, that was certainly a lot of it. And if you'll remember, that was delayed. It was supposed to come out in 93, I think, originally. But at the same time, they're at the height of their powers. Again, they've beaten everybody. And so basically in 1995, they're essentially doing their victory lap. I've heard, this is off the record stuff, but I've heard from some people that they were thinking that Gates might have retired. He might have retired in 96, 97, had the internet not happened and the web not happened. Gates is not dumb. No one would ever accuse him of that. He knew that networking computing was coming. And as I argue in the book, the only mistake that he made was that he thought that he had to wait for the technology to catch up. He thought that broadband had to reach critical mass, and he figured that would happen between 2000 and 2005, which, by the way, he was 100% right about. Mm-hmm. He also thought that, again, you know, he's a technologist, he loves computers, he wants a computer on every desk in every room, but he didn't actually believe, this is my theory, backed up by research and things that people have told me, that the computer could be a mainstream device. He thought that if networking computing was going to take off for normal Americans, and again, in 1995, home PC penetration is around 30%. It's not even 50% yet. So he thinks it's going to come through the TV. What's in every home in 1995? A television. So he thinks, I'm waiting for broadband. I'm waiting to deliver it in TV. If people can remember, there were huge investments in things like web TV that Microsoft made at the time. Mm-hmm. But if you're also old enough to remember, there was this buzzword called the information superhighway. And that's essentially what people conflate it now and think, oh, well, the information superhighway is just another name for the internet and the web. But it wasn't. It was a TV-centric vision of doing shopping, of doing movies on demand, music on demand. He thought that Amazon would be a thing that Microsoft would dream up and deliver to you through your TV, through a remote, maybe a keyboard and things like that. So the only mistake that he made was that the web came along and it was good enough to take off. And to his credit, he after a series of having come to Jesus moments, realized that. And then in 95, they get internet and web religion, and they furiously try to kill Netscape.
Yes, there's so many things like web TV, like that. I had a friend that worked for web TV, and I just remember thinking, like, oh, like she got on the wrong, like that's never going to work. And it's things like that, or, you know, things like streaming media in the early 2000s, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. things mm-hmm. that just like there's all these people that are just too early, like 5 years too early. And there's so many stories like that.
So many in the book, and what you just described, web TV. Oh, that's the wrong. Well, but it. What's Netflix now or streaming?
Apple TV.
Well, so there were companies like Sudo that I talk about in the book, and a lot. There was a whole bunch of others that I didn't even get to mention because everybody thought, oh, well, obviously we'll deliver to video over IP. But right, it was just there are so many stories in this book where. It happened at the wrong time. You know, Webvan blew through almost $1 billion to give you grocery delivery, which we now have. Mm-hmm. The original MySpace, the company in the 90s known as MySpace, was essentially cloud computing, cloud file storage. It was your space to save your files on someone else's computer. One of the things that is so fascinating about having done all this research. And one of the things that I wanted to bring into the book, having been a founder and an entrepreneur myself, is I don't care what they tell you when they go to the conferences. Any founder of a company in their heart of hearts knows that they were just trying whatever worked. No one has the perfect plan. Whatever that phrase is, the perfect plan dies at the when the battle begins or something like that. And this book is all about, especially the 90s stuff, people realizing, okay, this web thing is huge, but what works? What works in a virtual and digital paradigm? And so they're trying anything. And so what's huge? TV. Let's try TV. Mark Cuban is a billionaire today because he wanted to put it. Broadcast.com was all about putting first radio and then streaming video online. He wasn't wrong. He was just early, and he was also smart to sell out when he did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it makes you think, like, when I'm always hesitant to call any new idea, like, too ridiculous because it might mm-hmm. be the thing in 20 years.
Yeah,
you know, So that internet-connected toothbrush, like, might be the thing that everyone uses, and I just can't see the logic to it right now. So,
right.
Okay, let's talk about AOL. You talked to Jan Brandt, who was the mastermind behind all those CDs that, like, I have still visions of them, like, just in my mailbox and just the things we would do with them because you had so many of them. Talk a little bit about that plan.
Yeah, so, online services, again, we're dating ourselves here, but it's not exactly the internet. They had been around for a good decade, and they had been trying to make an industry out of, like, you use your computer to go online and do things. And AOL was a distant third to Prodigy, CompuServe, and had only amassed maybe not even a million subscribers yet. And this is maybe 93, 94. And Jan Brandt goes to Steve Case and says, can I have a couple $100,000 to in this point, print up discs and then later CDs? And he's like, what are you going to do with them? And she said, I'm just going to put them everywhere. And her intuition, as she told me when I interviewed her, was that I can commission all of these ads or even white papers or like we'll get people in malls and we'll sit them down in front of computers and train them. Because this is still a period where computers are scarce or rare in homes, and online is unbelievably scarce. And so how do you tell people what online is? And she just decided, I'm just not going to tell them. I'm going to give them a disc, and I'm going to try to get them to put it in their computer, and they'll figure it out for themselves. If I can just get them to put this thing in their machine and start clicking around, they'll find whatever it is that's online that will be the, aha, this is what online is, as opposed to me telling them. So they put them in, they freeze-dried them and put them in Omaha Steaks. They put them on seats in NFL games. And if you were alive, there was not a magazine, newspaper, book, anything that you could buy for several years that wouldn't have an AOL free trial disc CD in it. There's that famous Quora thread where something like 90% of the CDs produced in the late 90s at some point by like 98, 99 had the AOL logo on them. And this is at the height of CDs being the main medium of music and CD-ROMs and things like that. So they just, once it worked, I have a quote from her that they were at a conference and one of the, I think it was CompuServe, one of the rivals didn't recognize her. She was there with her boss. And he says, whoever that lady is at AOL, she's insane. She's spending all this money. She's littering the country with these discs and CDs. I don't know why they're still going with this. And she takes her boss aside later and she says, every time someone says that to you about me, I want you to agree with them, say I'm a dumb broad and that I have no idea what I'm doing, because they don't understand how much this is working. They're still trying to educate the consumer, and all I'm doing is giving the consumer the keys to the car and letting them drive off with it.
That's why there's more stories about men than women in here, just because women are smart enough to know, like, don't give me credit for that. I'm not sure if it's going to, you know, even if it does work, I don't want to, like, get the it working is more important than the credit.
Right.
So your book has a lot of dates in it that remind us just like the weirdness that I'd forgotten. It's not that long ago that like before 1995, people couldn't register domain names at all.
Yeah. And also before 1993, you could not legally do commerce on the internet. The internet by law was supposed to be a thing. So you couldn't sell ads. You couldn't put classifieds up. You couldn't. And even though at the time there wasn't the technology to do transactions with SSL and things like that, that actually Netscape invented. As late as 1995, I had on, he's in the book too, I think, Kremen, I can't remember his first name, but the founder of Match.com, who also famously bought sex.com and was one of these very early domain name squatters or investors, I guess is a better term for it. So as late as 1995, that's one of the reasons that Amazon only got started in 95. Once they could get domains, then they had the whole process of figuring out what the domain was that they wanted.
Yeah, that's a great story in the book, too. Yeah, so, I mean, that's why you used to see, like, for a long time, it's like the real, you would understand a site to be real and true if it had the /, you know, it was a university plus /, whatever, you know, a million things. Everything else was a little suspect.
Because the only way that you could have access to a web hosting account is if it was through your company or through your university. So, again, like Yahoo, its first thing is stanford.edu / Akibono or something like that / Yahoo. Because, you know, it was a research project to begin with. And then also, you know, it wasn't like, well, let's go out and get the domain name for this thing, which is the first thing that every business does today.
So let's move on to the early search engines and Yahoo. So Yahoo, you write, was never a tech company. Talk a little bit about that.
It's funny because I did a lot of literally going to the library and getting magazines from the time, because not every Fortune and Forbes, some magazines are better and newspapers are better at their archives than others. And then there's a lot from the time that are gone, like Industry Standard and things like that. It was surprising to me that as early as 1996, Jerry Yang is telling interviewers, or it's telling journalists straight up that we don't want to be a tech company. First of all, what people forget is that for a very long time, Yahoo was not even a search engine. It was a directory, and they had hundreds of paid salaried employees whose job was to surf the web, and then when they find a new website, put it into this hierarchy. It was a glorified Yellow Pages for the web, but that's what people needed in 1994 and 1995 and 96. Again, because, you know, it's not, well, go to Amazon.com. It's go to something, something squiggly / whatever. But they also didn't, because they knew that there was nothing to differentiate just being a glorified directory. So they knew that they had no moat, Warren Buffett would say, but they had no technological advantage. If AOL had been the first one to come up with a really robust directory, they would have had the Yahoo before Yahoo. So they intuited very early on that, first of all, we're going to brand ourselves as the friendly place to go on the web. And then number two, we're going to brand ourselves as the useful place and the fun place. And so what Yahoo pioneers is, you know, what seems obvious today is that you don't just go to the website to search the internet. You also they have free email there, and you can put your calendar there. And if you give them your zip code, they will give you your local weather. Your tell them your favorite team. They'll give you the latest sports scores for your favorite team. So they felt that they were a media company from day one. And they were very successful doing that in the 90s. And then the bubble burst and they struggled for a while. But then Terry Semel comes in and basically replicates that plan. And from day one, from 1996 through the Terry Semel era, they want to be a media company for the 21st century. And they, on some level, you have to say they succeeded in that. It's just that I don't know. Other people were more successful and more mature media companies later.
Yeah, I think by the Terry Semel time, they had sort of people had forgotten that they had not ever claimed to be like a technical tech company. Because mm-hmm.
They always try. Yeah. So I guess maybe they were trying to not be a tech company to maybe Hollywood and Wall Street. But then, like you and I that were around that, like we did think of them as they were the first great web company, mm-hmm. a company that existed on the web that couldn't have existed had the web not existed. But I have a quote in the book from Jerry Yang from 1996 where he says that we're looking for our Seinfeld and Friends. That search is what people are coming to us to learn about Yahoo. But our plan is to create what did NBC call the Thursday night lineup back in the 90s?
Must-see TV.
Must-see TV. They wanted to have must-see TV for the web. And he's saying this in 1996.
Yeah, that's funny. So the search engines before Yahoo, they were very bad, right? I mean, that was like...
Certainly.
AltaVista?
I think it was AltaVista that most people thought was the best at the time. Do you remember? Are you hearing from the Peanut Met Gallery?
Carson is giving the thumbs up that it was AltaVista was very bad.
And then,
AltaVista was not very bad.
AltaVista was the best.
He's a AltaVista OG.
And then it's weird, they competed at the time on these weird metrics. I think it was like Lycos had the most pages indexed,
right.
And there was Excite, of course, and I don't know, Northern Light, and we could go on and on and on. There was a million of them.
Northern Light. Oh, I totally forgot about that one.
Or Dogpile. Everyone remembers Dogpile for some reason. Because Dogpile was supposed to be all of the, because search didn't work.
Right.
And you didn't know one search engine would be good for this kind of search and another. So Dogpile says, well, none of them are very good. So we're an aggregator of search engines. So come to Dogpile and search all the search engines through us. And then hopefully we'll surface for you. If Lycos gets you the best result, then we'll surface that and things like that. But here's the secret. And we know this story is that all of the search was not a broken paradigm. All of those search engines could find you pages related to whatever you're searching for. What they couldn't do is surface the most relevant page for what you were searching for. The solution that to search was the relevancy that Larry and Sergey's PageRank algorithm created. And so even though if you searched on Excite, if you were searching for windsurfing, you would find the page would be there, but it might be on page 900. But Larry and Sergey's relevancy algorithm put that at number one, and then the game was over.
Yeah, exactly. Well, in the very late 90s, I worked at a company called LookSmart. I don't know if you remember. You remember LookSmart?
100%.
So they hired a bunch of liberal arts majors like myself. I wasn't a recent graduate. I was probably like 25 or 26. But recently moved to the Bay Area where I had to make more money than my job at a bookstore made me. They hired us to sit there in a room. And it was a Yahoo clone. And they had some people doing a directory, and then they hired this group of people called us search editors, or I think that's what we were called. And we answered people's questions. So like we would actually answer people's emails. This was the, you know, the .com bubble, which we will get to that you write about greatly. But yeah, it's it was people would ask us, like, where do I find, you know, the best thing to get blood stains out of my clothes? I don't know. That's kind of a
so
dark
you know,
one.
So a little bit Quora, but then a live Quora sort of thing.
Yeah.
You know who else I learned from researching the book who actually was a somewhat successful before he made Wikipedia was Jimmy Wales at doing Yahoo clones, essentially, or like not Yahoo clones, but more directories for specific niches and things like that. I had no idea, but actually in the .com era, he had some success doing that.
Yeah. Well, it's so many of our emails that we would respond, we'd basically say, here, try this brand new search engine. It's called Google, and use these terms and it should get you your results. So like basically we were an advertisement for Google, and not surprisingly, it didn't. I think LookSmart still exists in some form or another, but
I'm sure Dogpile still exists form or another. Hold on. I'm looking right now. Go on.
Okay. Well, you look at Dogpile, and then we'll talk about Amazon, but, and we'll talk about what happened there, and we'll talk about Google and eBay and Facebook and all of our old friends. But first, I want to take a minute to thank our sponsor, which is LastPass. Now, if you you probably already know, if you're listening to this, you know to have a secure password, you know not to use the same password, you know to use numbers and letters and not write it down on a little piece of paper and have lots of them. But if you work with a large group of people, chances are maybe not everyone knows that. And maybe you have passwords that you need to share among your company. And there's not a super easy way to share if you don't use LastPass. But LastPass is it's great for personal use. It's great for business use. We use it here at Twit, which I love. It's part of our benefits, I guess. We have personal and business LastPass. LastPass makes password sharing convenient for employees while keeping access to corporate data secure. It also allows for full customization of access, including the ability to set master password requirements, enable password resets, and restrict access when needed. You can configure over 100 policies. You can access security reports. You can create shared folders, organize database logins, SSH keys, software licenses, and business information. You can also protect your business with multi-factor authentication. So if you use the LastPass Authenticator app, which I recommend that you do, I love it, a verification button will pop up on an employee's phone to guarantee they're the only ones with access to their accounts. If credentials are compromised, the app ensures outsiders will not have access. The LastPass password generator makes it easy to use unique random passwords that employees don't have to remember, and they don't have to write them down. Employees can log into LastPass with the Microsoft Active Directory credentials, so they truly have only one password to remember. Data is encrypted and decrypted at the device level. Data stored in the vault is kept secret, even from LastPass. And brand new in iOS 12 and Android Pie, autofill functionality makes it easier for employees to seamlessly use LastPass across every one of their mobile devices. When you open an app or visit a mobile site, the keyboard itself will offer you your username or password as an autofill option, similar to what autocorrect looks like now. So no more copying and pasting from your LastPass app. LastPass also offers LastPass Premium, and that's for personal use. LastPass Families, so your entire family can use the same account, or you can use LastPass Teams, and that's for teams of 50 people or fewer. I love LastPass, as I said before. I don't know what I would do with it. My mind is just full of a bunch of stuff that, and every time something else goes in, something has to go out. So hopefully it's not passwords. I just leave that all to LastPass. I only have one password, and that's all I have to remember, just one. More than 16 million people trust LastPass, the number one most preferred password manager. Learn more at lastpass.com/twit. That's lastpass.com/twit. And we thank LastPass for their support of Triangulation. All right, Amazon. Now, Amazon is a really unique, one of the most unique companies in your book, because it started out as the, it wasn't the first, they weren't the first people to sell things on the internet, but they were the first biggest, and they're still the biggest. So talk a little bit about the beginnings of Amazon.
Yeah, well, real quick though, I do want to point out, like, there's so many stories in this book of where the one that wins is not the first one. It's like the, you know, that saying that leaders always get arrows in their back. You know, it wasn't Facebook won, it wasn't MySpace, but even before MySpace there was Friendster. Even before Friendster there was Six Degrees. The fact that to this day the number one e-commerce company in the world by far, I think last week I heard 59 cents of every dollar spent online it goes to Amazon, it was the first, is actually, we got to give them a lot of credit for that, because again, like, you know, no one swooped in and ate Jeff Bezos's lunch. How did it get started? Jeff Bezos is he's working on Wall Street at a firm, a quant firm that's actually competing tooth and nail with Bernie Madoff's quant firm. And the internet and web take off, and he's assigned by his boss, D.E. Shaw, to David Shaw, to research this as a business opportunity. And there's the famous story of he sees how the internet's taking off, and he realizes this is the biggest thing of his life. Is he going to regret leaving Wall Street behind, leaving his Christmas bonus behind? No, he's going to go off and do this internet thing. And he and Mackenzie, his wife, drive across the country, and he's typing the business plan on his laptop, and they don't even know where they're going to go. Okay. There's several different internet stories, internet founding stories that I've had to debunk in this book. I spoke to Shel Caffin, who was employee number one at Amazon. He said, well, funny story, Jeff had been out to San Francisco the month before to hire me, and the other employee number two, I can't remember his name at the moment. And we knew we were going to Seattle because he had already done the research. If they're going to do books, the Ingram and Taylor are the big book warehouses, and they have warehouses in Oregon. He doesn't want to be in California because California has a sales tax or a higher sales tax. And so we knew we were going to Seattle. So, okay. And the same thing happened with eBay. The whole idea that eBay was he wanted his fiance to have a place to trade Pez dispensers. That these are stories that are made up because they're nice, cute little PR stories. But I think the bottom line story of Amazon is that Jeff Bezos, I believe this, saw the internet, saw that it was the greatest thing that would ever happen in his lifetime, the greatest business opportunity. And what I don't believe is that he knew. I think he intuited from day one that it could be an everything store. I think that e-commerce could have efficiencies of scale and efficiencies in terms of being more convenient for consumers. But he started with books because I believe, if everything we've read about him, I believe his mind works this way. He was going to test the hypothesis. Now, as soon as he proved that books that people would buy things. Because remember, in 95, in fact, again, back to my library research, as late as 98 and 99, I'm reading articles after article after article in Forbes and Fortune and Business Week. When are people ever going to trust doing commerce online, putting their credit cards online? There was a real question of if it was ever something you could train consumers to do. So to conclude my theory about Bezos, is that he needed, his brain works this way, he needed to prove his hypothesis. Once he proved it, then it's pedal to the metal. It's going to be everything. Again, there's all those quotes from the time of people working with him in the warehouse when they're boxing the books themselves. And Bezos is dreaming of a time when, you know, we could sell camping equipment. We could sell cars. We could sell literally everything. So once books and media, especially because right after books came CDs and things like that, and God, VHS cassettes, then it was to the races, and we are where we are today.
Yeah. I mean, do you think that he imagined putting all those businesses, like all the bookstores, out of business?
Bookstores haven't gone away. I was in a Barnes & Noble today to find my book there.
Well, I mean, Borders, for
example. Borders had its own problems. So the question you're actually asking is, does Jeff Bezos want to take over all of commerce?
Yes, that's the question.
Probably. I think he'll take as much as he can get. And again, so far the thesis, the hypothesis continues to be proven right and right and right. And then the true genius of Bezos is to getting the scale of infrastructure. As people have said, he built the Buffett style moat by having the warehousing and the logistics and the infrastructure in place that literally no one's going to catch. Even people like Jet and Walmart are still trying to catch.
So what happened? What was Amazon's role in the dot-com era? I mean, they weren't like you don't talk about the dot-com era as, you know, it was Amazon.com, but that's not, you don't think of them as, that's not the era when they were coming up. Like what were they just happily chugging along and not doing anything crazy? And I mean, they weren't making a profit at that point.
No, but no one was. So this is a little nerdy, and I don't even go into much detail about this in the book. But there's this concept, especially in Wall Street at the time, like in the 80s and 90s, there was this concept of category killers. So you have, you know, Borders and Barnes & Noble kill the book category. You have Bed Bath & Beyond kills the home goods category. There's Home Depot for, you know. So when the dot-com era starts, what we remember are things like pets.com for pet goods online, toys.com for toys online. And so what everyone thought was it was going to be like it had been for the last 15 or 20 years. So, okay, well, Jeff Bezos has cornered books. And okay, yeah, he's moving into music and movies. But those are like books. You can ship them in boxes and things like that. But so one of the things that caused the dot-com bubble to happen is everybody thought, all right, Bezos has got category X. What's category Y? What's category Z? And so that is what, not only is that what a lot of the money was thrown at, but it's what we remember, what the popular imagination remembers, if you remember the dot-coms at all, is because they, all those companies spent so much money to try to market to us, to try to build their brand in the way that Amazon had. I think that Amazon, at least in the dot-com era, basically focused on media, and people thought that they were going to stop there, and they never stopped.
Mm. We sort of skipped over one other point, which was the community sites like eBay and portals, and I guess this would be the time of Craigslist as well.
Yeah. Which I actually had to cut out of the book. I had a little bit about Craigslist. Let me just make a real brief point about eBay, because I actually wrote a piece about this in Entrepreneur recently. eBay quietly is maybe one of the most influential, because we don't think about eBay. We think about the FANG companies, Facebook, Amazon, Netflix, and Google. Think of the three things that eBay gave us. I was just telling you how much people were afraid to do business even online. eBay taught Americans how to trust strangers online, number one, that you could buy a stereo from someone in Nebraska and never meet them, never know their name, never see their face, and somehow it would magically all work out. So I think that eBay went a long way to training Americans not only to trust strangers, but to trust the internet. Number two, how did they do this? By creating that rating system so that you had reputation, so that you could trust a seller that had ratings and things like that. We live in a tyranny of the five-star review now. How would we have things like Uber and Airbnb had eBay not proven that you could create this sort of ad hoc, decentralized reputation system that it's not perfect, but works well enough most of the time? And then number three, eBay never owned anything. I tell the story in the book when the newspapers start coming around kicking the tires at eBay, because for whatever people might think, the newspapers were not dumb. They knew that their classified ads cash cow was endangered by the web and the internet. And they tried to come. Jeff Skoll is there. Jeff Skoll, as you might know, is one of the co-founders sort of eBay. And he says in the book that the guy that wants to come and buy them says, well, I'm never going to get this past my board because you guys don't own anything. Like, what tangibly do you have here? And they try to convince him, well, we have the value of our community. We have the value of what our members are doing on our platform. So again, we're used to that today, that social media, you know, Facebook is worth $400-500 billion, makes billions of dollars a quarter, but own nothing. And they don't even produce anything. All of the content on social networks and social media are produced by the members, And so eBay number three, I think, deserves credit for proving that that was possible.
Well, so you say that eBay really showed us how to trust strangers, and that was true if we just went on eBay and said, like, mm-hmm. you know, I'm going to give you money so that you send me that sweater. But I don't know that it's all. I mean, we can give them a little blame too, because what we were really trusting is the crowd, right? Like, we were mm-hmm. trusting, I wouldn't send money to the person with a sweater unless, you know, they had a rating, which meant a certain amount of people. Right. And so back then, that was great because those were actually people. But now they're not people anymore, right? Now we're trusting, like, oh, okay, well, you know, this tweet has 5,000 retweets. It must be correct. It must be accurate. I must be able to trust it. So, like, maybe they have some of the blame of, because those are, you know, no longer people. There are a lot of bots. They're just a lot, or it's just a lot of, you know, people living in their bubble wanting to believe something. So, I mean, you can trace back the problems we have right now in, like, trusting the wisdom of crowds or bots back to eBay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I agree with you, actually. I would say that and maybe one of the reasons is there was always money behind eBay, so you can't fake that. Like, you know, like, there's zero marginal cost for sending another spam tweet or whatever. But if you don't deliver that stereo, or, like, you know, the check or money order or credit card doesn't come through, I would give more blame to the shift from Yahoo to Google to Facebook, in this sense. Now, granted, there's no way that a human curated directory could have ever scaled to the internet at the size of today, but even the size of 2000 2001. So when Google and their algorithms solve the search problem, and they do it at scale, and the more pages they feed the algorithm, it's recursive, it gets better and better and better. And so I think that maybe the problem that we have today is that once they proved they could do that, and they did the same thing with AdWords and AdSense, because remember, Tim Armstrong is here in New York in 2000, 2001 with, like, 500, an army of actual ad salespeople. And then AdWords and AdSense is completely automated, and you can do it by yourself. And so they fire all the salespeople, and it's a self-serve advertising model. I think that the problem is that, so Facebook comes along in the wake of this, and in a lot of ways, I think that Facebook really cribbed a lot of things from the way Google did business. And they're like, well, there's no need for human curation. There's no need for an actual human to have their thumb on any of these scales, because the math all works. And I think what we're learning right now, or I hope that people are learning, is that, yeah, I know that the algorithms and the math are still the most efficient way to do things, especially at scale. But I really think we need to bring humans back and put their thumbs on the scales for a lot of things, especially involving humanity.
Yeah, agreed. I mean, I think comparing to, like, I use a site called Poshmark, which mm-hmm. is sort of like eBay, you know, like, you just sell your old stuff. And I'm not so much, like, I don't necessarily look at people's reviews anymore. It's just, like, I use it because, like, you give a percentage to Poshmark. Like, there's a middle man in there, probably women, but that are, you know, like, if somebody doesn't, like, they don't release the money until I get the thing, and, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. I don't, and so, like, and if it's not what I ordered, then they're in between. You know, there's a middle. Like, I don't trust.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't, like, I'm not, you know, I don't have the same sort of trust I used to have in eBay or Craigslist. Mm-hmm. So it is a human there. But, yeah, I mean, that's, we're talking about advertising versus delivering goods,
right,
which is kind of different. Let's move on to the .com era. Let's go to the mm-hmm. pets.com puppet, the wonderful time to be alive, that amazing time where everyone knew it wouldn't last, and yet we were still buying it all, or not buying it, but still, like, I remember I got married in 2000, and it was when I was working at Tech TV, and they gave me, as a wedding present, my husband and I, they gave us a DVD player, and it came from Cosmo.com. So, like, they just, it wasn't that, I think they hadn't thought about getting me a gift, but it was like within, they ordered from Cosmo.com, and Cosmo.com gave us our first DVD player, and it came in 30 minutes. So, but that was just ridiculous. They were never going to make money, but
right.
Talk about that time.
So, right. You know, the Cosmo was famous for, like, if you ordered Ben and Jerry's, you could have just gone down from your apartment in New York City, because they were mostly in New York City at first. They would deliver it to your door for less than you would pay if you had just gone across the street to the bodega. And yet they still had to pay that delivery driver. Yet they still had to have the refrigeration and the warehousing and things like that. But again, that was like that whole, again, Jeff Bezos taught everyone, get big, fast, kill your category and worry about profits later. Mm-hmm. And it worked out for Bezos, although it almost didn't, but that's an entirely different story. But the dot-com era is sort of about this. The pets.com example is they lost money on every bag of dog food that they shipped. Dog food's an expensive or not an expensive. It's a heavy item to ship. And, mm-hmm. you know, they've got to compete on free shipping. Webvan, the grocery shipping place, they were supposed in the original business plan, they were going to make their money on the delivery charge. But then to quickly gain market share, they waived the delivery charge. So every single delivery lost them money. But then there were things like the numbers are in the book, but I'm going to go off the top of my head now. When Pets.com does its IPO, they raise $70 million. That's the other thing that's weird about talking about this time is those seem like minuscule numbers now. And they turned around and they spent like 50 to 60 million of that on marketing. And because from the time of their IPO to their bankruptcy is 10 months. And so they can raise – not only are they losing money on everything that they sell because they're selling at under cost, you're talking about the time period where like everyone – and I have in the book people talking about, well, they're giving me free this and free that, and I'll take the free one from this one month and the free one from the next month. They're all trying to gain ubiquity. They're all trying to kill their category. They're all trying to get customer loyalty. And they're spending tons of money on Super Bowl ads and, by the way, on ads at AOL and Yahoo. And so it's this Ponzi scheme / musical chairs when the music stops sort of deal. Yahoo is making money hand over fist in 98, 99, into 2000. Because they're sucking up all this money from these dot-com companies that are trying to market themselves, that are trying to get big fast. There's also examples I have in the book where companies will IPO and take every last cent of the money they raise and turn around and give it to AOL because they want to be the premier, stock company on AOL or whatever. So it's just raise as much money as you can, blow as much money as you can, as quickly as you can. It was a frenzy, as you mentioned. It was a crazy fun time. if you're in these companies, if you're a consumer and they're giving you free stuff every other week, it's crazy. But it's also the point that I make in the book about the dot-com bubble is that it feels like to this day in Silicon Valley and the tech industry, anytime someone has success, everyone's like, oh, the dot-com bubble's back. The 90s are back. The bubble's back. But it was a really unique time that I don't think can really ever be replicated for other outside reasons, Wall Street reasons, baby boomers bringing a ton of money that needed to be invested somewhere, all sorts of other structural reasons that I don't think we'll see again in our lifetime.
And so how does the dot-com burst compare to like the 2008, like the real estate? Like what were the, because mm-hmm. I know that like the dot-com burst felt so important to me. And I definitely knew people who had got in on all kinds of IPOs in their company. And then all of a sudden, they had no money.
Everyone I knew was out of work. Yeah. Everyone I knew was out of work.
Suddenly. No job, no money, even though they mm-hmm. had all this money on paper just before, and mm-hmm. they had maybe bought a house and gotten a crazy mortgage. And then, how did the two connect in your mind?
Between 2008 and the bubble? Well, on the one hand, I do make the point in the book that the dot-com bubble was the first time that Main Street Americans learned what a bubble meant. It was also, I have statistics in the book that the people that started investing in the 90s, something like 70% of them got started after 1995. So there was a lot of people that this was the first time that they're saving for retirement and that goes away. Unfortunately, I think that then the housing bubble was worse because it was just like, well, that was a fad. That didn't work out. We learned our lesson. And then just a few years later, when people are pumping up this other thing, people are like, okay. I missed out. I try to outline sort of the last months of the bubble, and everyone knows it's a bubble, but if I just hold on, maybe my company will IPO. If I just hold on, maybe my eBay stock will double again, and then I'll get out, and then I'll get out. It's waiting for the greater fool sort of thing. So I think that a lot of the housing bubble was people like, all right, I got burned on that one. This time I'm going to be smart. And the problem is that housing is such a greater percentage of the overall economy of the country and the world, and it is tied into so many other industries that even though a ton of money was evaporated in the dot-com bubble, and it did lead to a recession, and that was also touched off by 9/11 and things like that, but it was still sort of isolated from the larger world and U.S. economy, and then the housing market and the housing industry was just more integrated, and so it was worse.
Mm-hmm. So then you move on to Google, like mostly the Google IPO and Google AdWords and Napster, sort of like phoenixes mm-hmm. rising from the ashes. Talk mm-hmm. a little bit about that time.
Yeah, the point that I make in the book, and I'll just make this point and then move on real quick, is that so Google solves search, which is genius. The second thing that Google does that is genius is create the greatest advertising engine ever devised by humanity. But they did not invent that. They adapted that or stole, depending on your definition, from another dot-com company called GoTo.com that became Overture. They did it in a way that was googly. Overture was basically just a pure pay-for-play auction. If you're willing to pay $50 a click, you'll be number one on our search engine or whatever. And Google did it as Google is wont to do. They made it a little smarter. They added quality scores and things like that. But I like to point out that Google is two miracles: solving search, creating this amazing advertising engine. Only one of those things Google did itself. The other thing it stole. I'm fascinated by the Napster story because, again, this is something, you know, I was, what, 21, 22. I was leaving college or whatever when Napster hits. And so I was one of the guys that was, using my college broadband connection to download songs and things like that. Everyone remembers it as piracy. Everyone remembers it as, digital disrupting an industry. But what I realized is, and this has been proven out, that what it really was is today we live in a world, especially in terms of media, where people expect unlimited selection and instant gratification. And if I tell you about a TV show, a movie, a song, you expect that you can dial it up in 10 seconds and listen to it as much as you want. And any song, any book, any TV show, any... And the Napster guys at the time were screaming that, listen, we know that right now this is mostly piracy. We know that right now people are being attracted by free music. But that's not really what's going on. This is a better delivery method for media. And unfortunately, for many various reasons that I do go into in the book, it was a completely star-crossed startup. It was doomed from day one. But they weren't wrong, and they were envisioning Spotify. They were envisioning Netflix. They were envisioning that people would be willing to pay for unlimited selection, instant gratification. They weren't wrong. They were just too soon, and they picked the wrong industry to pick a fight with also.
Absolutely. Yeah, I remember I was a new mom, like in, I think it was 2003, it was when I started, and I remember downloading a bunch of music and just thinking, like, I had the moral quandary, I'm a parent now, I need to set a good example for my mm-hmm, infant. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I would say, like, well, as soon as they come up with the way, that isn't walking into a CD, a music store and buying, a CD for $17, then I'll pay. And, the next thing is the iTunes store and the iPod.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. And, so the only reason that iTunes succeeds, a couple reasons. Number one, there's the Napster example. Number two, Steve Jobs is a rock star. in his own right. He's a legitimate media mogul at this point because of the movie studio.
Oh, Pixar.
Pixar. So when he goes to the record executives, he's going as an equal, and they're burned, and they have been trying to create their own Napster killers on their own. But the infighting and these two music companies have their own system, and these three have their own system. And there's great episodes of the Internet History Podcast with people that have lived through this. Rob Reed, founder of Rhapsody, and things like that. So Steve is a rock star. He's an equal to them. He's saying, listen, you guys are hemorrhaging money. Let me solve your problem for you. But crucially, as I point out in the book, Apple was a non-player in the internet era up to this point. They have less than 5% of PC market share. You never even mentioned the fact that Apple is the most profitable or the most valuable company in the world now, one of the biggest technology companies. In 2001, they were nowhere. No one was worried about them. And so the reason that Steve Jobs was able to cut those deals is because he was able to say initially, although a year later they changed this is just going to happen on Macs. So we're not going to break things. You know, just let's play this little experiment. And then when the experiment is wildly successful, then they're like, all right, fine. And they renegotiate and they make it Windows. And then Steve Jobs has his arm twisted, and Apple people at Apple convince him, oh, we need to make these for Windows machines as well. And so then Apple and iTunes and the iPod and the gadget era.
Yeah, yes. The stuff. I guess it was the time we needed stuff in our hands. And that's the... the Palm era as well, or is that, did we skip ahead too far?
Oh, no. We can talk about this, but then we should come back to social before the mobile era is another example of it was just too soon. I can remember my brother coming to me in 2002 and had a phone where he could get Florida Gator football scores and basketball scores on his phone. And I was like, well, why would I ever want to do that? If I want to find out what the Gators did last night, I'll go on my computer and turn it on and find out. So I feel like the first half of my career, mobile was always something that almost like VR today or other things. I was told forever is the next thing, and it really was the next thing forever. Going back to the Newton in 1992 and 1993 that Apple created, and IBM had a My Simon, and then the Palm Pilots, which I had, and people, tech people had, and business people had, and then the Blackberries. But again, until the iPhone. It was still a niche product where, you know, BlackBerry was hugely successful as late as 2005, 2006, and their install base is only 20 million or 30 million. And those numbers are off the top of my head, but they're in the ballpark of what they actually had. Not a billion, 2 billion or whatever. Mm-hmm. So again, it was just a case of it was too soon. Wi-Fi didn't go mainstream until 2002, 2003. We didn't have 3G till after the iPhone anyway. So it was just you got to give Apple credit for conceptually getting the smartphone right from the very first try. The point I make in the book is that the automobile, it took 40 years to get the configuration the way that we experience it today. There's no longer a crank on the front, that sort of thing. It's amazing that the iPhone, they got that conceptual design right from the very get-go, but they also were fortunate to come out at the exact right time when the technology there was there. But then also, and this can lead us into social, there was something to do with these devices that came out at the exact same time.
Right, exactly. Okay, we'll get to that. And I love that. That is some of the I think what's so key about your book. And as you were talking before about, you know, it being important for younger people who didn't, you know, necessarily live through all of this as adults, that the iPhone, you know, when I first read that sentence in your book, was it was conceptually perfect. I was like, well, there wasn't, you know, it wasn't perfect. Like there was no cut and paste.
App store.
You know, there was no app store. And so, of course, but then to think about that, you're exactly right. The concept was perfect from the get-go, whereas, you know, that, and maybe that, you know, wasn't true for any other company. But yeah, I want to talk about social and the iPhone and all the rest. But first, I want to talk about something that people might think is crazy right now, but I don't. It's a toilet with technology built into it. I'm talking about the Toto Washlet. You've heard Leo talk about this. I've used it at his house, and it's very nice to use a toilet that is very warm, and the seat opens for you when you come in, and it closes for you, and it's also a bidet. I have not used Leo's bidet, but he raves about it, so he says it's great, and you should trust him. You've trusted him in a lot of things. So let's talk about the Toto Washlet. It is easy to install, and you can instantly upgrade your bathroom, upgrade your current toilet. It's just like a smartphone. So once you've experienced Washlet, so think about that first time you experienced the conceptually perfect iPhone. That's how you'll feel when you try the Washlet. You'll look back and wonder how you ever lived without it. Numerous models are available for you to choose from, each with varying levels of advanced technologies and features. Auto open, close lid, like I talked about. You just walk in your bathroom and the toilet seat, it opens to greet you and then closes when you're finished. That's good. You don't have to touch it. And it avoids all those arguments that anyone with a partner of the opposite sex knows, that leaving the seat up, and, you know, maybe even not a partner of the opposite sex, it's don't leave the seat up no matter what. It's bad. Enjoy a comforting heated seat that feels like you've just wrapped yourself in a towel straight out of the dryer. Or you can turn this feature off. You don't need it. It's hot in the summer, you don't need it. It's very easy to turn off. With a touch of the button, a wand extends from under the seat for a soothing, warm water cleanse. The automatic deodorizer will circulate the surrounding air over a filter, and that neutralizes odors. Certain models even feature cutting-edge technology that will keep your toilet clean, and that includes a pre-mist spray that spritz your toilet bowl before you use it. And afterwards, models with eWater Plus, that's electrolyzed water, that will spray your toilet bowl for you. There are other advancements. There's a nightlight, remote control, on-demand water heating. That means you never run out of warm water. So you can, many of them feature, not all of them, but you can customize your toilet. That's one of the best things about it. Don't forget, you'll be reducing toilet paper and helping the environment. This will impress your friends. It will be the newest and most popular small home appliance in the coming years. Every day, more and more people experience the clean revolution. So you can experience it for yourself. All you have to do is go to wayfair.com/triangulation. Then you'll get more information there. Use the promo code triangulation at checkout. So that way they know that we sent you there. And also you'll get special savings when you make your purchase. We know you'll love this innovative toilet seat, and it will change the way you experience clean. Wayfair.com/triangulation and enter promo code triangulation to check out. There's several models to choose from. Toto makes it easy to find the perfect toilet for you, and we thank Toto for their support of triangulation. All right, so Facebook. Did we skip anything? Are we ready? Obviously, we skipped what came before Facebook, Friendster, yeah. And Six Degrees, which I vaguely remember, was reminded of reading your book. So how did that all, I suddenly just remember Friendster happening. I don't remember why, or maybe it was like after AOL Instant Messenger. Was that something that maybe led into it?
Yeah. And I talked about that, about how AOL really could have had a social network. There's even, we're skipping over this, but there's chapters about like the AOL Time Warner merger, tied in with the bubble bursting and the Microsoft antitrust trial and things like that. But yeah, I do point out that AOL could have survived because it actually had the social network that everyone was on as the bubble was bursting, and like to the tune of hundreds of millions of people. They just didn't know what they had. Funny thing about Six Degrees, which most people consider to be the first social network as we would recognize it today. Again, this was a too soon thing for a very simple technical reason, which was that digital cameras weren't a thing yet. Mm-hmm. There's a quote in the book where they're having these you know, feverish discussions about how we can convince people to get pictures and scan them and email them to us, because you can't do profile pictures. So what good is social networking if you can't like take a picture of the party you're at last night, or the sunset, or your dog, or your baby, or whatever? So too soon. digital cameras only go consumer mainstream around 2000, 2001, but they're not on things like smartphones yet. Or, but there are no smartphones. They're not on cell phones. And then Friendster comes next, and Friendster simply runs into the technological challenge of they just don't know how to scale things like that yet, because it's an engineering challenge to for a social network, because each and every user has to see something different, and something has to be propagated that's different every time you log in. And I had Jonathan Abrams on the podcast, and he will straight up tell you, he's been on many places and been interviewed many times, he's like, we didn't have the chops, we didn't have the engineering right, we were too soon. MySpace does this better. MySpace also was super successful at a time for not both Six Degrees and Friendster wanted you to be your authentic self in the way that Mark Zuckerberg eventually wanted you to be on Facebook. It's one of the reasons MySpace took off, is because you could be whoever you want. You could be a fakester on MySpace. You could be Tila Tequila and share whatever you wanted on MySpace. And so I'm sure you can remember, too, there was this whole period into 2004, 2005, 2006, when Rupert Murdoch buys MySpace, where it seemed like MySpace was the winner, but you kept hearing about this college MySpace clone. And I was out of college at this point, so I couldn't see why people thought that this was superior. And so everyone, I think, has a general idea of the Facebook story. You know the movie story, and the movie story is not necessarily inaccurate. They took a lot of artistic liberties and things like that, but they also focused on a part of the story that was more dramatic. So what I wanted to do in this book was to tell you more of the story about the founding, and like, what were the problems? Why did they win? Why did they almost fail? What were the problems that they overcame? And what I ended up focusing on a lot was how much it seems that Mark Zuckerberg was not convinced that he was on to this great idea. Sean Parker has said many times and various interviews and stuff that Zuckerberg was obsessed with doing WireHog, which was a Napster clone, that he was happy that this social networking thing, this Facebook, had taken off. But he really thought the thing was sharing in a different way, sharing media, sharing your files, sharing things like this. And, I got these quotes from other articles and other books, but there's these that summer in Palo Alto, and Sean Parker is having to take Zuckerberg aside and say, this is the thing. The social network itself is the thing. And Zuckerberg's saying, do I really have something here? Yes, Zuck, this is it. Focus on it. And then the whole I tell the story of all the times that he could have sold out for $1 billion to Yahoo. He could have sold out to $1 billion for this one. And he almost does this time. There's a quote from Parker in there. I think it was the Yahoo offer that was the closest they ever came to selling. So I was interested in trying to tease out, why did he stick with it? What was the time? Because I'm more fascinated. Again, this gets back to the hagiography of company foundings and startups. And well, 20 years later, I was a genius and I knew from day one. But again, you get the sense, it comes throughout the whole book, that they didn't really know what they were doing. And even when they were having wild success, they didn't trust it. So I was trying to tease out, what were the things and the moments that made Zuckerberg especially, but all the Facebook people realize what they had and stick with it? Because again, Friendster sold out, MySpace sold out. Why couldn't they have sold out for $1 billion, $2 billion, and who would have blamed them? Mm-hmm. So I spent most of the Facebook chapter trying to tell that story and trying to figure out. I'm more interested in the entrepreneur that learns how to be a great entrepreneur, that's not born genius, but at least has the intelligence to recognize when they found something, and then the fortitude to actually follow through and make that a great company.
And do you think Bezos had that? I mean, because you talked a little bit about how he sort of, there was that myth around, we didn't even know where we were going, but that wasn't accurate. I mean, do you see him as different?
Yeah. That's funny. You're the second person this week that's asked me about that, comparing specifically Zuckerberg and Bezos in that sense. I think that it's easy to think of him now as the Terminator because he's all buff, but I think Bezos is just an analytical machine. And like, he's relentless, and like, you know, things will fail like the Fire Phone, but he has these, he has a general idea of what he thinks that will work, and he will methodically and relentlessly test things out and see what works. And then the key thing is that when he gets traction, then he's willing, and, you know, famously to be unprofitable for 20 odd years or whatever, he's willing to double down, triple down, reinvest to the point of almost, you know, every time I interview an Amazon person that was around at the time, I'm like, how close do you guys think you went to going bankrupt in, like, say, 2002? I've not gotten anyone to really bite on that one yet. But he's, once he gains traction, he will go after it tenaciously. So I think that's his genius.
Yeah, I mean, he's never the person that you hear saying, like, I just want to change the world, or I just want to like bring the internet to India, or, you know, bring the internet, like, where everyone else is sort of, you know, Google and Facebook are especially saying that, like, okay, it's fine, you know, that people are sharing their baby photos, but look what else we can do. Where I think Bezos is really like, we're selling stuff, we're going to give you the best price, we're going to take care of you.
I have a theory about that, actually, because Bezos can say and be honest about it, that he wants to deliver the best customer service. He wants to deliver you the lowest prices, the greatest convenience. He wants to, heck, if you're out of AAA batteries, he hopes one day soon to have a drone delivered to you within 5 minutes, right? That's, he doesn't have to be disingenuous about that. Now, whether you can say, well, in the back of his mind, he's really going to kill every other retailer in the world. The problem that, my theory is that the problem that Facebook, Google, and a lot of other people have is that we're sharing, we're bringing the world together, we're bringing the world closer, we're changing the world. No, you're delivering ads. I think especially Larry and Sergey are ashamed of that on some level. I'm not sure how ashamed of that Mark Zuckerberg is, but I think that that's the problem, is that you can be working at Facebook and believe that you are on this mission to make the world a closer, more connected place, and that will change the world, and it has. But at the end of the day, your paycheck is because you're finding a way to sell me laundry detergent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the product is the laundry detergent. The product is not us.
Right. Well, we are the product. We are the product, because how are you selling me that laundry detergent? By tracking that I have looked at other laundry detergents, or that I, you know, have a new baby, so I might be in the market because diapers and blah, 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 blah. But that's the thing, is that, so I do think that the problem that certain companies have is that they want to hide behind, not hide behind, they want to believe they are doing the change the world stuff. But they know at the end of the day, when they have to deliver that 20% increase to Wall Street quarter over quarter or whatever, they're doing it by selling ads, and then more ads, and then more invasive ads, and then ads that they can charge more for. And they have to have some sort of disconnect in their brain about that. And it's troublesome.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you can see where, growing up on TV, you know, we talked earlier about how the TV was in every house. Like, there were ads, and you sat through them before TiVo, and you watched them, but you understood that, like, that was how you got to watch great television, through advertising. But then it wasn't as targeted. It wasn't like, oh, you're showing me that ad for laundry detergent because I just had a baby. And
there's Tim Wu has that great book, The Attention Merchants. First, his great book is, of course, The Master Switch. If you've never read it, read that. But the most recent one was The Attention Merchants, where he talks about these things. And before radio and TV, you could never get inside people's homes. And so radio and TV was finally, you were able to market to people inside their homes, right? And that was as far as technology could go until the internet. And now the internet, you're essentially inside people's brains. You're seeing what I'm doing because most of our life is lived online now. Because now you have access to my phones. You see where I go. You see my thoughts and desires and my impulses. And by the way, we should point out that Amazon is going in this direction too. You know, why are people putting smart speakers in our homes? Because they're hoping to market to us and things like that now. What I think was, I agree with you. And people quite rightfully so derided the TV for 50 years as the boob tube. And it's just making us dumber, and it's just in aid of selling us laundry detergent. However, the problem is that there was a technological limitation. They could only go so far. They could only determine through Nielsen ratings who was watching this show and who was in the market for a car and things like that. It was all inference. And now, because these technological devices are essentially surveillance devices, they keep pushing and pushing, and the envelope gets further and further and further. And Facebook says, here, put this portal device in your home, and we're not going to use it to target ads against you. Actually, we're going to use it to target ads against you. And so, 5 years, 10 years from now, those smart lights, your smart doorbell, your smart curtains, all those things are just going to be surveillance devices inside your home to market more and more and more.
Right. And then there's something about, I don't know, there's something about, like, let's say Amazon just came up with they just applied for a patent for some kind of technology that where you would cough, if you're coughing, then your smart device might recommend cough medicine, which sounds a little Black Mirror-ish. But when you really think about it, it's not as bad as what Facebook is accused of doing. Like, I'm posting a bunch of, you know, pictures of something that, like, I have sending all these signals by my family pictures or my friend pictures that are going to convince them that I might like have anxiety disorder or, you know, something that then they're going like, that's what they're accused of. It's just more nefarious. It's under the guise of like, we're just all sharing and connecting everyone. But then they're taking all these psychological signals and then selling me stuff like that. I feel much more comfortable with like, I cough. Do you want cough medicine? I'll sell you some.
Right? I agree with you. I agree with you because, and again, And I believe this, Jeff Bezos and Amazon says, we just want to be more convenient for you. You're sick. Don't even have to think about it. We're going to have a drone deliver you the cough medicine before you even have to ask for it, right? However, think of it this way. There's nothing to stop them from then selling that information to your insurance company.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
And so, Amazon doesn't feel mostly like a company that would do that. Facebook more feels like a company that would do that. But there's nothing to stop them. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. Where's the slippery slope and all that?
And not just that. They might be the insurance company.
Oh, that's right. I forgot about that. I forgot. Yeah. They're
so
starting their
own insurance. So we're screwed. Whatever.
Let's
talk about something better. The iPhone. So this all leads up to the from Netscape to the iPhone. I don't want you to give away your whole book. There's so much more that we didn't talk about. You still need to read it. But what? Why end at the iPhone, I guess, is my question.
Well, again, because I don't think you can understand the modern era if you don't understand how social got here and how mobile got here. But the reason that mobile is important is that I think it wasn't until 2000 that home PC penetration in the United States passed 50% for the first time. So the fact that now what the mobile revolution really is the ultimate culmination of the computing revolution. Until smartphones got ubiquitous, we did not have the majority, and again, caveats of first world developed countries, but also in developing countries increasingly, you did not have the majority of people computing, using computers on a daily basis. And again, she hates that I trot her out to do these things, but my mom has used computers for 20 years, but she used them sparingly. She sent emails. She looked up things when she needed them. She, did work for her work but she now uses a computer like everyone else, what, 80, 90 times a day? Because she has a computer in her pocket. And the reason that I end with the iPhone and the point that I make in that last chapter is that, as we said, there was a whole bunch of pioneers trying to make mobile computing happen. Palm, BlackBerry, the Newton, the Simon, all these things. And the for the technical reasons that we talked about, broadband over networks and 3G and things like that came, and then the fact that the batteries and the screen size and all these things that people have explained about why it happened at the same time. I posit in the book that it's possible that the iPhone could have been like a BlackBerry, where it would have been super successful, but it still would have been just for business people and busy people and things like that. But the iPhone comes out in 2007. There's something else that happened in 2007 within months. I think it's within 10 months. And that's Facebook opens open registration. As we said, I couldn't figure out why everyone loved Facebook, because I couldn't get on it because I didn't have a .edu address. In 2007, Facebook opens open registration and everybody gets on. And if you were alive at the time, you remember this. There was no one on it. And then seemingly overnight, everyone you knew was on it. And people that you had lost touch of was on it. And then your grandmother was on it. And then everyone was on it. I think that the reason that the iPhone took off, aside from the great design, aside from Steve Jobs being the greatest showman of our era, is that at the exact same moment, social took off. And so the iPhone, or the smartphone generally, is simultaneously the perfect consumption device for social media, but also crucially the greatest production device for social media. So a year later, when the App Store launches, what are the 30 key flagship apps that launch on the App Store? Facebook was one of them. And so would social networking have taken off had smartphones not taken off at the same time? Would smartphones have taken off if social media wasn't there to be the perfect thing for people to do with them? So again, a theme of this book is timing is everything. And simultaneously, the iPhone comes, Facebook is open to everybody, and here we go, we're in the modern world.
Brian, thank you so much. This you got to read this book, How the Internet Happened. If you lived through it, a lot of this I missed just from having three kids almost at the same time. So it's good to relive the 2003 to 2005 years in here. If you want to get into the business of the internet and you are 20 years old, I highly recommend this book just to have a basis and just to read the stories, because they are interesting and they're not the made up stories. They're not the eBay, what was the thing?
Pez dispenser
stories. Mm-hmm. So thank you so much, Brian McCullough, also host of the Internet History Podcast and the Tech Meme Ride Home. He's at Brian MCC on Twitter. Any other place? Obviously, the book can be bought or downloaded or listened to anywhere.
Yes, ebook, audiobook version. Yes. So wherever fine books are sold, as they tell me to say.
Who reads the audiobook?
Not me, by the way, because I have to do a daily podcast. And I was afraid that if I lost my voice, either the book would be screwed or the daily podcast would be mm-hmm. screwed. So I can't remember his name, but he's a very talented narrator and voice guy. So,
okay. One last question. Sitting down to podcast or sitting down to write, which do you prefer?
I'm not sure that I'll do another book, and I'm really enjoying podcasting right now.
I think that answers my question. It's interesting that one was intended to support the other, and now,
They support each other. Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Well, I have a degree in writing and I prefer sitting down and talking to people than down by myself. Brian, thank you so much for joining us. Brian McCullough, check out the book, read the book, and listen to all of his podcasts. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Megan.
And thank you for joining us on Triangulation. Triangulation records every Friday at 3 p.m. Pacific. You can download any of the episodes, any of the interviews we've done, twit.tv/try. If you want to watch live, go to twit.tv/live. Hang out in the chat room and listen and comment. And just download all our podcasts, subscribe. And it's really important, if you like these interviews, tell a friend, because that is a good way for us for the word to get around that we do these long form interviews that are fun, I think, to listen to, hosted by me and, of course, Leah Laporte and Jason Howell. And thank you so much. We'll see you next time on Triangulation.